This is The Takeaway. I'm Arun Roth, filling in for Tanzina Vega this week. Today on The Takeaway, we're going to dedicate our entire podcast to a painful topic: sexual abuse within religious institutions. Last week, Pope Francis acknowledged for the first time that nuns have been victims of sexual crimes by religious leaders in the Catholic Church. Coming up, we'll hear one nun's account of the abuse she faced.
I don't remember conversation before or after. I only remember that she took my face in her two hands and kissed me all over my face. And then I just remember leaving. I felt the same way I felt as a child. I felt lost. I felt abandoned. I felt confused. I felt alone.
That story of abuse within the Catholic Church coming up later. But for now, we turn to another denomination, one that was founded right here in the U.S., the Southern Baptist Convention. Just this weekend, a new investigation revealed decades of sexual abuse by church leaders and volunteers. Compiled after 6 months of reporting by the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, the investigation found that since 1988, some 380 church leaders and volunteers have faced allegations of sexual misconduct. To date, 220 have been convicted. Some took plea deals, others confessed or resigned, but others are still involved in churches where they may have access to potential victims. The perpetrators of these crimes came from all levels of power within the church, from youth pastors and ministers to Sunday school teachers and deacons. There are more than 700 victims. Joining me now are two of the journalists who helped report this investigation. Robert Downen is a reporter with the Houston Chronicle, and Lisa Olson is deputy investigations editor at the Houston Chronicle. Robert and Lisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Arun.
Robert, can you start by giving us a sense of scale here? How big is a Southern Baptist church? How many churches are there, and how is it structured?
So I think that's a really important thing and dynamic to this story is that, unlike the Catholic Church, the Southern Baptist Convention is very decentralized. While we do reference, you know, SBC leaders within our story, there is no pope or someone who can, you know, make decrees and force other churches to do really anything. A bedrock of the Baptist polity is local church autonomy, which means that the 47,000 churches that cooperate as part of the Southern Baptist Convention really are self-governing and independent, which is one of the reasons that implementing reforms to stop the kind of sexual abuses that we found has been a difficult thing, speaking among the broader Southern Baptist Convention.
And it's a wide range of churches across the country, you know, the mega churches to small town churches.
Sure. And I think also there's a tendency to think, because of the name Southern Baptist Convention, that all of these churches are located in the South. That is incorrect. We found, you know, cases in New York, cases in Oregon. While the name implies that they are based in the South, they are very much a nationwide and really worldwide organization.
Now, your investigation found a pattern of sexual assault and abuse. How far does this go, both in time and geography?
So we wanted to focus on the 20-year period since 1998, because 2008 was the year that Southern Baptist Convention leadership, the executive committee, rejected a lot of reforms that activists and victims had said would have helped prevent sexual abuse. And so what we found, as you mentioned at the start of the show, 380 church leaders and volunteers who faced sexual misconduct allegations, and that includes, you know, those who were convicted, charged, credibly accused, and successfully sued or confessed or resigned. But as you said, you know, it's not confined to any one type of church. We found these cases range, you know, from mega churches in Houston to tiny, tiny little congregations located in rural areas.
Some of the stories that are included in this investigation are very troubling to hear and read about. Could you tell us about Anne Marie Miller's story and how it fits in with the larger patterns you found in this investigation?
So Anne Miller was, she was a teenager when a youth pastor that she knew started a relationship with her, allegedly, that turned sexual. That man, the case against him is pending right now. But Miller, after learning that he had gone on to work at the Southern Baptist Convention's mission board and was a somewhat high-ranking official there, she met with the mission board in 2007, and they had an internal investigation that mission board officials said at the time supported her story. And after that investigation concluded, her alleged attacker was able to leave, go work at churches in Arkansas before finding work at the South Carolina Baptist State Convention. And I think her story was kind of a watermark when it kind of broke in July for a lot of Southern Baptists. You know, they've been grappling with a few high-profile scandals involving sexual abuse and the handling of sexual abuse in the months before that. The response from mission board officials that came to light when Miller came forward, I think definitely was kind of a wake-up call to a lot of people about how these things have been handled internally often and some of the language that's deployed when talking to victims. I think this, the quote that stands out is from a mission board official who, just after the investigation had concluded, they were trying to ask her to forgive the attacker and, you know, move on with her life.
We read these reports of some of these women having abortions as a result of the sexual abuse. Were the perpetrators of these crimes, Lisa, were they pressuring these women to terminate their pregnancies?
There are a couple of cases where the perpetrators pressured the young women, often they were teenagers, to terminate pregnancies to hide what happened. There's also a case of Debbie Vasquez, who had the child of the person who molested her, and he required her or asked her to stand up before the congregation and apologize for her sins, knowing all the while that he was the one who had done this to her. That's one of the people who came forward early on and asked the leadership in the SBC to make changes was Debbie Vasquez, and so we focused on her. Even though that is entirely true, that there's this concept of local autonomy, these churches also elect leadership. They elect an executive committee every year, and often these are pastors who serve 2 years in the positions of president, vice president, and they really do set some general guidelines and policies for and the direction for the entire church. So one of the things we did look at was how some of them had handled individual decisions at their own churches, as well as failing to act on some of the reforms victims like Debbie Vasquez wanted.
We hear some of these really disturbing stories from the survivors of the abuse, but you also sat down and interviewed some of the predators who are now behind bars. What did they have to say for what they had done?
I did the interviews with our videographer, John Shapley, and he and I wrote to 20 different people who were in Texas prisons because we had in Texas more perpetrators like this than in any other state, in part because the SBC is such an important church in Texas. And three of them agreed to sit down and talk to us. There were others who wrote to us. The three of them had really different attitudes. One of them was from a very small church in a very small town and was very, I would say, repentant for what he had done. He considered what he had done to be sort of a mental illness. And he really spoke very eloquently about how he felt the Baptist church in particular was not honest enough about problems within the church, whether it be pastors or parishioners who deal with sex addiction or pornography addiction or other kinds of problems. And that the fact that the churches do not discuss it allows it to go undetected. There was another pastor I interviewed, a youth pastor, who I think was very much expressing repentance for what he had done. However, at the same time, he was conflicted, I think, about it. He, though, said clearly, youth pastors in particular have opportunities to get too close to teenagers, and there's a slippery slope between being a counselor and a pastor. The third person, a guy named Steve Livingston, who was a deacon at a church in Corpus Christi, expressed really no remorse at all. In fact, he considered himself a victim. He abused several little girls who were in a church program, and he was driving them to movies, and they were sitting on his lap, kind of considering him sort of a grandfatherly figure, and he abused them.
Is the Southern Baptist Convention doing anything now to prevent abuse from happening in the church? Have they taken any steps to reform the church to protect people?
There's definitely movement towards that. Leadership has definitely, in their comments publicly, you know, said that this report, they welcomed it and the information in it. But again, one of the main things that's been suggested by activists and victims and some people within the SBC itself is this database of people who have been convicted or credibly accused or confessed to sexual crimes so that these churches can know before they hire someone what they're getting into or what this person's history might be. And so we went ahead and did some of that work for them. And if you go to HoustonChronicle.com, you can find a database of about 220 people who were convicted or took plea deals in the last 20 years.
We've talked about the material you covered in part one of this story, which is out now. There are two still parts to come. Can you give us a sketch, a little preview of what the next parts will focus on?
Part two, which we'll publish tomorrow, is about the pastors and others who successfully moved from one church to another, finding new victims along the way. Cases we've documented across the country. There are 35 of them that we share in that story and in a map. And part three is about, in particular, youth pastors who prey on teenagers, primarily both men and women, and the particular types of mechanisms they've used to abuse teens, which include a lot of use of social media and texting. Very disturbing stories.
I'm wondering if you have a sense of how comprehensive this is. Do you feel like you've got to it all, or is there still more in terms of abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention that needs to be reported?
We had a three-person team, and I was one of the people who took a list that Rob created from searching news articles nationwide of people who might have been convicted and then tried to track down whether they had been convicted all across the country. If our basically three people in a matter of a few months could assemble proof that 220 people have been convicted, if the churches actually collaborated and provided all that information, the search tool would be infinitely larger. We're hearing from crowdsourcing now lots and lots of stories from people about cases we missed. And many of these cases happen in small counties. The records aren't online. They don't have newspapers that have archives online. So there's no way for us to find out about all of these. And then there's a lot of people who were never prosecuted, but who probably should have been. So I know we've just gotten a small part of which is a big, much bigger problem.
That's Lisa Olson, the Deputy Investigations Editor at the Houston Chronicle. Robert Downen is a reporter at the Houston Chronicle. The first of their three-part series was published over the weekend. You can read the investigation on HoustonChronicle.com and on MySanAntonio.com. The other two parts of their investigation will be released later this week. Lisa and Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
We turn now to another unfortunately familiar story, sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. For years, the conversation around sexual abuse by Catholic clergymen has focused on the abuse of children by priests and bishops. But last week, Pope Francis acknowledged publicly for the first time that nuns have also been victimized. Reports have surfaced around the world in recent years of nuns being assaulted by priests. The Vatican Women's Magazine last week wrote that some nuns were forced to have abortions after being raped, and that nuns have resisted coming forward about their abuse for fear of retaliation by the church.
Sisters would be very ashamed to talk about that and bring it into the light. So I believe it was there, and I believe it was undercover, in darkness and in secrecy.
Mary Dispenza was a nun in the 1960s and 70s and continued to work for the church for years after leaving the order. Today, Mary is the national leader of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, and is the nun abuse contact for the organization. She is a survivor of rape by a priest when she was 7 years old at her Catholic elementary school. And she was also abused by a nun when she was a young nun in training herself.
I don't remember conversation before or after. I only remember that she took my face in her two hands and kissed me all over my face. And then I just remember leaving. I felt the same way I felt as a child. I felt lost. I felt abandoned. I felt confused. I felt alone.
I spoke with Mary about the atmosphere and power dynamics in the church that led to her own abuse and that of so many others at the hands of both priests and nuns. She began by telling me about a letter that a nun posted to her Survivors Network website just a few days ago. And we need to let you know that this conversation contains graphic depictions of sexual assault.
It's about the abuse of sisters in her order at that time, which was called the Minor of Mary Immaculate. And it talks about her own psychological, emotional, and nearly sexual abuse that caused her to enter the hospital while she was in the convent. But she witnessed how the nuns covered up with a bishop and tolerated and allowed sexual assault of her sisters by other sisters, benefactors in the order. Alcoholism was tolerated and severe punishments were given, like beating, starving, and imprisonment. The church allowed this for years. She reported it to the diocese in 2004 and said the diocese said there was nothing they could do. She also says there was racism in the religious order when an African-American sister would be called a black dog by her superior. There was a death of an Italian sister who was imprisoned and not allowed to see her family or get a medical attention. Another nearly died. And then she says, how it affected me. I have autoimmune disorder and PTSD and anxiety. I cannot attend Mass without physical complications or panic attacks. Have I given up? No. It's time to stop the silence and speak the truth and let the healing begin.
That is a horrendous account. One thing that I wonder, and it might sound naive, but you'd think with one of the advantages of having a hierarchy in a place like the church is that you would have recourse to a higher authority. That if there is a priest who was abusive, you should be able to use the hierarchy to address that. But it doesn't work like that, I guess.
No, it's very sad. There are many priests, bishops, they're all somewhat implicated in the issue of priest abuse, clergy abuse, abuse of children and nuns, because they're complicit in their secrecy and their silence. They're going to maintain the silence to protect each other. My experience has been when survivors have turned to the church, so to speak, or nuns have returned who were abused, turned to their superiors, they get a deaf ear.
Can you talk a bit about the power dynamic, how that played out in your own experience with the church?
Yes, I can. And with my child abuse at age 7, the way the power dynamic affected me or impacted my life at that early age was a priest, of course, violated me. And already at age 7, I knew that the priest was God, God's manifestation on earth. And I also knew that what happened was bad and wrong, even though I was just 7. And so because of that power dynamic, I felt I had to keep it a secret. It caused me to simply leave my abuse behind and go on as if it didn't happen.
So Mary, if you could you tell us what happened with that priest when you were 7?
Yes. Well, my mom, she worked in the parish office. So one day, lunchtime, I'm 7 in the second grade, I'm looking for my mom. They told me that she was in the lunchroom. So I happily skipped across the street and went into the auditorium, which is connected to the lunchroom. And my mom was there and the ladies were talking, and I decided I would open the door and go into the auditorium, but it was dark. And then I quickly noticed the light coming from a machine, and it happened to be a movie projector. Something was playing on the screen. I continued to walk, and eventually I was near the machine and also near a priest sitting quite close to the machine. And he beckoned me to sit on his lap. And of course I did, because why would I not? He was Father. And so I sat on his lap, and I was so close to the machine, and I was actually remember being intrigued by it because of the sound and one wheel going around the other and the film going from one to another. And then in a moment, everything stopped. Everything went black. And the priest had his fingers into my vagina. And I don't know how long. It seems like 10, 15 minutes in my mind. And then he walked me to the back of the auditorium and he left me. And I went into a small bathroom there and I washed my hands and I washed my hands. And even at age 7, I knew something very bad had happened. And I believe that's when I split in two. I left little Mary on the bathroom floor, and it took many, many years before I went back and reclaimed her and picked her up and said, you're okay now. And after that, I went into the lunchroom. Still today, it really touches me about that little child. I went into the lunchroom. But I didn't tell my mom. I didn't tell anyone. My saving grace, if there was one, and it has been, is I turned to God in my own little way. I already knew that God knew everything, my most secret thoughts, words, and deeds. And I became a life. That became a moment where I began a lifelong conversation with God, which exists today.
That's dreadful. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Mary, you're in an unfortunate position to be able to have this perspective that I'm wondering if you could talk about how the church's response to the issues of child sexual abuse, of abuse by nuns, and of nuns being abused. How is the church's take with each of these scandals? Has it been the same, or?
I think it's been the same in that there's a shroud of secrecy and a desire to protect themselves and the cover up and pass on predators, which is a great crime and a great sin to hurt and molest more children. I think that's how it's been handled mostly throughout the past decades. And it's just now that voices, like the story I read, the one that said, you know, this is my testimony, it's time for me to speak out. Just recently, persons are beginning to speak out. But again, in relationship to the non-abuse of children, there has not been a word from religious orders and or the Vatican. So we see how covered up these crimes are and shrouded and continued. In order, I believe, to protect the good name of the orders and of the church. And until those terrible tragedies can be faced, there can be no real change in the Catholic Church. You know, it's good to admit a problem, as perhaps we could say the Pope did by saying the priests, nuns were slaves of priests. But admitting a problem is far from solving it. It really is time for action. The Pope should, you know, take a stand and move to zero tolerance. And so should religious orders. If any are within their ranks, so to speak, are perpetrators, they should be sent away, defrocked, fired, whatever word you want to use. Because until that clean sweep, so to speak, is done, the church will continue to have that great big elephant in their room, in their closets, and it's just sad, isn't it? I'm getting very sad at this moment.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of why it seems that the issues with nun abuse have stayed in the darkness, perhaps longer than some of these other scandals?
Well, I think women have had the role of always taking a back seat, and just by virtue of being women, often we're the last to be addressed, to be heard. That's one piece. The other is this piece of clericalism where women in the church have been subservient to priests, to the bishop, and wouldn't dare speak out because of fear of retaliation. Like in the story we heard earlier, the fear of not being believed. The nuns, the religious women of long ago, were brought up in such a way that we were humble. We didn't speak out. We were taught not to really stand up and speak out, but to be humble, to follow the rules, to be obedient, and especially to our pastor, the bishop, and the pope. Those are some reasons. And again, the piece of what would we do if we started telling these stories? We would probably find that so many of us have been implicated in one way or another. Now, who wants to do that? So they have a lot to, the church, religious orders, and the world has a lot to do with coming to terms of how they, everyone has been a part of this in one way or another. But to move forward, it has to be done.
Hearing you talk about that, it's making me think about this hashtag, hashtag nuns too, which has been getting traction. And you were part of that, right?
Right. It's just so fascinating to me because it seems like it's at least a year ago. I must look back when one day I thought, well, I'm just going to start a hashtag. Like it was just like, well, I guess I can make a hashtag. So I, you know, followed all the directions and I called it nuns too. Well, through the months, what emerged surprised me in that I was really hoping for survivors of nun abuse and or nuns who were abused by priests. But by and large, it is voice after voice registering upset, concern. They're appalled with this piece of church action.
Well, and could we unpack that nuns to reference? Has the hashtag Me Too movement affected survivors of abuse in the church?
Yes, I think so very much, because I think the reason that I'm getting so many calls about survivors of nun abuse, besides being the contact for nun abuse, is that this group of survivors has never had its light of day. And I think they're saying, what about me? What about me? They want their stories to be heard. They want their day in the light. They even want settlements when possible and recompense. You know, some have had such tragic lives putting the pieces together, alcoholism, drugs, unemployment, and this is not fair. And the church has a serious reckoning to do about that, and so do religious orders and other persons and groups that have molested and raped and cost people to live a lifetime of putting their life together and the pieces back together and healing and moving on to purpose and meaning.
So, Mary, could you talk about why you ultimately left the church?
Leaving the church was one of the most difficult things I did, because over half a century my life was involved in church, in ministry, in service. I was a principal, a national distinguished principal. I was appointed as director of the Pastoral Life Services Department by the bishops. And so it was no small thing for me to finally, probably I was about 56, 7 years old when I finally said the words, when people would always ask, are you still a Catholic? I finally was able to say, no, I am not a Catholic. And the reason was really twofold. Certainly the way the church was handling abuse and survivors was a piece. And secondly, at the time that I was dealing with my priest abuse, I was also facing the fact that my affection and love was for and with women. And I was so naive. I was still directing the pastoral life service department at that time of coming out. And I thought they would be happy for me. Now, that was very naive. But I really believed what they taught me, which is we are made in the image and likeness of God, and that the greatest work we have to do in our lives is to be who we are, like the glory of God, are we fully alive. So, you know, I believe that, and I believe it too today. So I was like thrilled, and I started my coming out, started telling my colleagues, and eventually the message got to the bishop. And the end of that particular work year, I was fired. And eventually I got to see him, and I told him this was not fair, that this was my church as much as his church, and that he owed me the right to be a part of this struggle and journey around sexuality and embracing the different ways we love in the world, and that God is a part of that. And that really, that's when my world fell apart, when he told me by coming out and speaking out about that, I was featured in a piece on coming out, that I broke allegiance with the Catholic Church. That's when I really felt a great big whammy. I felt betrayed. I felt, again, abuse upon abuse. And that is when I said, this church doesn't fit for me anymore. There's no place for me. There's no place for my love. There's no place to be married or blessed. And it's still I wish it were differently, and it isn't. And I understand that. Churches can define who they are, but it doesn't mean it's right. And so I've worked hard for that too, for marriage equality and for survivors to heal. And I'd like to say to survivors, you're not alone. And I'd like to say to men who love men, women who love women, you're not alone. And transgender men and women, you're not alone. And someday, maybe, just maybe, you may be welcome in all churches.
And even without the church, you still have that dialogue with God.
Oh, absolutely. I would be lost without God. God for me is many things, including energy, love. Shows up in you, shows up in me. And that kind of understanding of God is my stronghold, gives me comfort. It helps me with courage to move forward. And God is my salvation and my rock.
Mary Dispenza is a former nun. She's the national leader of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, and the nun abuse contact for the organization. She's the survivor of child sex abuse by a priest and abuse by a nun. Mary, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's an honor.
We've reached out to a number of representatives of the Catholic Church in the United States for comment on Mary Dispenza's story. We have not yet heard back. Remember, you can check in with us on any topic. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and leave your take. Also, you can tweet us at The Takeaway and tweet me at Arun Roth. That's Roth, R-A-T-H. That's Indian. That's how we say it. Thanks so much for being here with us this hour. I'm Arun Roth, filling in for Tanzina. And this is The Takeaway. Back with you tomorrow.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.